I'm Stuart Kelter, and this is Delving In. My guest today is Professor Colin Wayne Leach, who is a social and personality psychologist at Columbia University, who has studied status and morality in identity, emotion, and motivation. In addition to authoring nearly 100 journal articles and book chapters, he has co-edited several books, including Psychology as Politics, Immigrant Life in the U.S., The Social Life of Emotions, and Societal Change. Today's interview will focus on Schadenfreude and related emotions. So, Professor Leach, welcome to Delving In.
Thank you for having me.
So before we start, I just want to explain my own interest in the topic. I'm a psychologist, a clinical school and prescribing psychologist. And I've always been fascinated with the relationship between dominance hierarchies and mental health, which is, I think, well studied in the field of ethology, which means study of animal or human social behavior from a biological perspective. But it's not really talked about that much in clinical psychology, when I think it should be. I mean, my own view is that, for instance, depression, I think, has a lot to do with not feeling comfortable with one's place in the dominance hierarchy. Like, you feel like you should be, you know, closer to the top, and you can't, and you feel a loss of self-esteem from that. I think it's really a key factor. And Schadenfreude, which we'll get to in just a second, is very much wrapped up in that whole concept of dominance hierarchies and where you are and needing to feel higher than you are. So what is Schadenfreude, and how did you get interested in studying it?
I think, you know, you can define Schadenfreude sort of most simply as taking pleasure in another person's misfortune. And the way it's used originally in German is really pleasure in really kind of small mishaps caused by happenstance, tripping and falling, or minor things. In English now, since we borrowed the term, we use it maybe a little bit more broadly. But that's basically the simple definition. And I got interested in it really early in my graduate career. I had always studied emotions as an undergraduate. And my first work as a graduate student was with Richard Smith, who studied envy. And we started doing, I think, some of the first published work in social psychology and personality psychology on Schadenfreude because of its possible relationship to envy. And just generally, I'm just really interested in emotions where that put people at odds with others, that kind of, you know, threaten or damage social relationships. And Schadenfreude is certainly a case in point.
So would watching the slapstick of someone slipping on a banana peel, would that be a kind of a mild example of Schadenfreude?
Yeah, and that's actually the more typical one in its original usage. It's really sort of minor things, not serious injuries, not serious downfalls. But little pleasures like that. Yes.
Yeah, I know that some writers have said, I'll leave it to the Germans to come up with a word for that. But according to Tiffany Watt Smith, who's an historian of emotion, she named a whole bunch of words in other languages, I think French, Italian, Japanese, that are pretty similar. So I don't know why it was from the German that it was taken. I came across on the internet, one of the first usages was by Francis Power Cobb, who was an animal rights campaigner. And in the 1990s, she wrote a whole manifesto entitled Schadenfreude. And that may have been like the first popularization of the word in English. And she identified it with the emotion of bloodlust of boys torturing stray cats for fun. So that's the more serious end of Schadenfreude.
I kind of maybe stand out from other people who study Schadenfreude. I like a very narrow and precise definition. So I would not call that Schadenfreude. Now we're talking about something like sadism or you know, taking pleasure in torture or violence, where you're actively causing the pleasure, basically, you know, eliminates that as a possibility for Schadenfreude for me. If you're actually actively causing harm, that's not Schadenfreude by my definition.
So Schadenfreude has to be the witnessing, in your view, the witnessing of the
yes.
taking down in status, actually torturing. That's really taking down in status. But I wonder, is it a continuum? I know that Richard Smith talks about maybe the Holocaust being derived in some measure from something like Schadenfreude, of bringing down the status of the peoples that they exterminated. I don't know.
I think, you know, there's a point at which some of these discussions are just about semantics. But there is, for me, and I have argued this, and I will say that, you know, not very few people agree with me, But for me, the importance of a narrow definition is, and this is what's nice about Schadenfreude, is that it's actually not used in common parlance in English. And so we should stick to a very precise definition. And for me, the whole point of emotion concepts is that they describe something particular. Yes, anything that is more active, causing harm, taking pleasure in it. This is also why I distinguish Schadenfreude from another German word, Genugtuung, which is actually pleasure in seeing justice done. There's a very particular quality to Schadenfreude that is about passive witnessing. And so certainly I think people who are observing what the Nazis were doing during the Holocaust maybe were experiencing Schadenfreude because they hated Jews. That would fit my definition. But actually being involved and actively making others suffer, for me, is a very different social psychology. And I really want to separate it from this more passive thing. And it goes with what you said earlier, which is, you know, what Nietzsche argued is Schadenfreude is passive partly because the people who are prone to it are people who feel powerless, disempowered. And so they aren't the people who are actively engaging in open conflict and direct conflict. And this really comes from Nietzsche. And I would say that's part of the reason that the history of ideas about why we borrowed that word is in fact because there is this tradition of very psychologically oriented German writers writing about Schadenfreude. There's Nietzsche, and then there's a sociologist, psychologist, Max Scheler, who published a book in the early 1900s. And that's, I think, really where it comes into psychology. It was, for many psychologists in the early part of the 20th century, they actually had to learn German and study German. And so German philosophy and early psychology had a huge influence on psychology. And of course, as you know, the Viennese and the Austrian, the Freud circle, Alfred Adler, the early psychodynamic influences, also a lot of that was written in German. So there's a reason why that concept, I think, gets picked up in psychology, and it is because of the German influence on psychology.
Yeah, and it seems to me that Schopenhauer and Nietzsche were kind of the experts, or Nietzsche especially, on this concept. He called Schadenfreude as the revenge of the impotent, which I thought was one of the pithier things that he said about it, but he was almost like an expert on the whole thing. And I suppose it's not like he was necessarily promoting it, but he was trying to understand it and not flinch from looking at it. Because there's something uncomfortable, it seems to me, about feeling Schadenfreude. It's both pleasurable and uncomfortable at the same time. So to give an example from Tiffany Watt Smith, she says she watched her three-year-old gloat. I don't know if it was her three-year-old, but a three-year-old gloats about how she's got the last biscuit and goes, na, 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 and then she's waving it around, and then our dog snatches it out of her hand.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know if that's Schadenfreude or the other one, Genugtuung, which is seeing justice done. You know, is it justice that someone who gloats over the last cookie should lose that cookie? And some of her other examples also, this kind of a humor in it, like when squirrels in my garden forget where they buried their nuts, when aggressive van drivers get flashed by speed cameras. Another one, when my brother took his kids on a fabulous summer holiday to America, I felt bad because I never take my kids anywhere since it's too much effort and it's too expensive. And then I saw his Facebook status, it rained. You know, so there is a kind of humorous element to it, especially if someone isn't badly hurt. And I think the average person, you know, might enjoy a little bit of Schadenfreude, but if it crosses a line into someone, you know, if they slip on a banana peel, that might be funny to watch in a movie. But if they slip and then, you know, break their back, that stops being funny.
No, that's right. And that's really informed by the sort of everyday German usage of Schadenfreude is about those sort of everyday minor misfortunes. And that's why, you know, that's part of the definition I talked about, misfortune. So it's not serious injury. It's not serious harm. This is, again, why I like to make these distinctions. So some of those examples that you mentioned, I would say, are not Schadenfreude, where, again, it's taking pleasure in seeing justice done. And it's relevant to what you just asked about. So we can take pleasure in seeing justice done even when someone is being punished pretty harshly for what we think was a major injustice. We have a little bit more license. It's a little bit more acceptable socially to see someone really suffer or have something bad happen to them if we think they've committed a pretty serious moral violation. And that's, again, part of the reason why I don't want to call that Schadenfreude. So you know, seeing someone who's been getting away with, I don't know, stealing from their company, locked up, is not Schadenfreude precisely because the deservingness of the punishment or the deservingness of the misfortune frees us up to take pleasure in it more openly. Those other examples you're describing are there. They're a quiet little smile. They're a little chuckle. They're not the same kind of pleasure, partly because Schadenfreude has this sort of furtive, quiet, you know, I can kind of enjoy it within certain constraints, but anything else would look really malicious and make me look bad quality. So again, this is partly why I like the narrow definition, because it is a very particular kind of quiet, underground, kind of hidden pleasure that we have to be careful about not expressing too openly, not gloating about it, not taking it too far, because then it makes us look bad.
So it makes us look bad. And is there also an element of feeling bad for oneself, that feeling kind of small in a sense for feeling it?
Yes. I mean, I think that's right. Although the people who typically feel it, right? So they're called the Schadenfreude, the people who feel Schadenfreude a lot. Partly how they feel it a lot is that they don't think there's anything wrong with it. But certainly I do think we have to worry about our reputations, as very few of us want to be seen as someone who's indifferent to other people's suffering. And so there's a fine line there. Now, this also maybe brings in the group element. In some of your examples, these are group situations where it's a community of people or a group of people who are taking pleasure in another person or another group suffering. And of course, the group also enables us to worry less about being judged, because if they're sharing the Schadenfreude with us, that also facilitates it and allows us to be a little bit more open in it. And that's another kind of interesting group dynamic that frees up Schadenfreude.
So there does seem to be a sense of the someone whose status feels too high or undeserved in a way, and then gets brought back down to size. But that's not just Schadenfreude. You're saying that could be Genugtuung, the sense of justice being done.
Yeah.
But if it's not a question of justice, like let's say somebody is just lucky, you know, and they got ahead. They won the lottery or even something much smaller than that. And there's another German term, Glücksschmerz, kind of undeserved luck. If it's a feeling pain at somebody else's ill-gotten fortune, or it's what seems ill-gotten or not deserved. So all these concepts, it seems like they're in a family of similar kinds of feelings that all speak to status differences and wanting them to be corrected somehow.
Well, yes, but you know, I'm kind of with you, and that's what I find interesting about emotion, is that there's a lot of emotion that's about status. I mean, we are status-oriented creatures, and as you said, we're primates, and we're very oriented to status, and we're oriented to status for good reason. It matters. It affects us psychologically. It affects us physically, physiologically, biologically. It affects, you know, how we live, how we eat, how we thrive. So I think you're right, but it's also the case, you know, anger is often a lot about status. Sadness is a lot about status. Shame is a lot about status. So status is just a major cause of feeling, because it matters, because we're attuned to it. And so, yes, it makes sense that to me, we'd have a rich range of emotions about status, because it just matters so much.
Well, here's an example. I'm wondering if this is Schadenfreude or if it's more Genugtuung. In the 13th century, St. Thomas Aquinas said that the blessed in heaven both see and rejoice in the tormenting of the damned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for me, that's a very clear example of Genugtuung.
And that may be one of the reasons why there's so much emphasis placed on heaven and hell. You need to emphasize hell not just to make people afraid to be bad, but to also imagine the reward of looking down from heaven into hell.
That's right. I mean, my favorite sort of person who made this point is actually Durkheim, you know, about drawing that line from the pure and the impure. It's not just about identifying impurity or wrong. It's also about reaffirming and reinforcing right. And that is, you know, one important consequence of Genugtuung, or taking pleasure in seeing justice done, especially a kind of a retributive justice where wrongdoers are punished. It's not just that they're getting their just desserts. It's also that the moral order is reaffirmed. that's kind of what that pleasure does, right? When we can celebrate when justice is done, it's affirming that we have a shared moral code that matters.
Yeah, I also couldn't help noticing that the concept of Schadenfreude is comfortably sits in psychoanalytic thinking. The idea of having displacement of status concerns, that it's not just that you see somebody brought down, but it could be someone who's not related to you at all. It's just sort of this almost symbolic kind of thing. I don't know, when seeing somebody mess up on American Idol, for instance, I mean, it has nothing to do with you, but you're seeing somebody who was trying to get high gets brought low.
Yeah, no, that's right. And I mean, I think that's the, in some ways, that's the scariest part of Schadenfreude at some level. You're feeling bad about yourself in some domain in your life, and you use the someone else's suffering or misfortune to make yourself feel better. Yeah, there is sort of a tool, basically. You're instrumentalizing this person's suffering to make yourself feel better. Yeah, that is in some ways the most sort of malicious part of it. Yeah, and the fact that it's strangers, I mean, it's worse, of course, if you dislike them, but you don't have to dislike them. They're just basically a tool by which you make yourself feel better, a kind of emotional succorance, Nietzsche called it. That's right. And it shows you again, you know, the attitude toward the person. If they're just a means toward your own selfish emotional ends, then obviously you're not very concerned about what's happening to them.
You can imagine yourself going on American Idol and failing, or that you realize you don't have either the talent or the guts to do it anyway. And so this way you can say, oh, I'm not so bad. You know, if this person is even worse than I would have been, you know.
Yeah, no, that's right. And, you know, some of us are really good at that, right? When bad things happen to us, some of us have that way of managing it, which is we try to find someone who's even worse off to make ourselves feel better. Yeah.
One of the examples that I thought of actually as a really good classic example, I think, so you'll tell me if it's true. There was a play in a movie about Florence Foster Jenkins, who was a very wealthy donor to the opera, I think probably in New York. And she fancied herself as an opera singer. Because she was such a huge donor, they let her sing. And she was terribly off key. And so people were laughing at her, and she thought they were laughing with her. And, you know, I think eventually she caught on, but it took quite a while. We actually had this produced in Las Cruces as a play with wonderfully performed by Lenny Brown, who was an actual singer and had to learn how to sing slightly off key in order to do. Mm-hmm. I think Meryl Streep, I think, played the role in the movies. You have this whole audience of, you know, very sophisticated people who are in other situations would be too sophisticated to admit to anything like Schadenfreude. And here they were all snickering and laughing. So would that be a classic example of Schadenfreude?
Well, we need to know more. So if they were taking pleasure because she overestimated herself, and because she had that opportunity only because she was rich and had given a lot of money, then I would say the main motive for that is actually just desert, seeing justice done, and therefore it wouldn't be Schadenfreude. It would be Genugtuung. But if you didn't know who she was, and justice wasn't a motive, and you were just taking pleasure in this little mishap, then it would be Schadenfreude. So this is really important. This is, you know, about the psychological conceptualization of emotion. We need to know people's motives and their relationship to the target. And so that means that the same different people witnessing the same event might experience different emotions. If I know who she is, and part of what's fueling my pleasure is her getting knocked down a peg or two, that means that it's something more like Genugtuung. If you have no idea who she is and you're just taking pleasure in this little misfortune, you might be experiencing Schadenfreude. And so that's really important for me, the relationship of the person experiencing it, their motives, and their relationship to the target tell us what the emotion is. And this is why we have to actually understand those things to really be able to precisely understand the emotional experience.
So in that audience, it might be a mix of people. You might have very wealthy people in that audience, almost as wealthy as Florence Foster Jenkins, laughing. You also have people who are wealthy, but not as wealthy. You also have people in the audience who, you know, got comp tickets or something, you know, or managed to get in as for a twofer. But then you have people sharing a clip of it from YouTube with a friend who's not into opera, and maybe the friend didn't explain very well what the whole situation was and still laughing. So it seems to me like it could probably cover both bases, both Genugtuung and Schadenfreude.
That's right. And that's why, I'm glad this has come up, because this is a major reason why I like these narrow definitions and this precision, because for me, the whole benefit of emotion concepts and having these really specific concepts like Schadenfreude or Genugtuung or gloating, a more sadistic pleasure, is because we're trying to understand the richness of human experience and people's psychological experience of the world around them. And so that's the whole benefit of these concepts. And so if we use them too loosely, then we're not actually rendering people's psychological experience in a precise and nuanced enough way. Yes, different people in those audiences are differently positioned, have a different status relative to her or to whomever. They have different motives. And so the emotion concepts, these labels, should help us understand different people's experience. And that's why we don't want to overgeneralize and you use labels too loosely, because we're not really then understanding in the most precise way individual people's experiences and the basis of that experience in their relationship to that particular target, to the world, to their own feelings of inferiority or inadequacy, to their feelings of competition and their motives. That's why I keep pushing for this precision, because I really want to understand people's experience as it is and not to make many assumptions about what they're feeling without really trying to understand where that feeling is coming from.
Now, is Schadenfreude considered a universal emotion, or are there cultural differences, or are the culture differences in the expression or to the degree to which it's suppressed or hidden? It seems to me that in the literature I've read, it seems like it's assumed to be a universal emotion, but there must be also cultural elements, I would think.
I would say that this hasn't really been studied very well about how universal it is. You know, it's actually a hard question to study. And I would say even the cultural elements haven't been studied that well. But I'm with you that there's lots of reasons to expect cultural and contextual differences. So, for example, if you're living in a tighter community and a community where solidarity and common feeling is more common, or where there are moral or ethical or religious rules against this kind of malicious feeling against others, then yes, you'd expect Schadenfreude to be more underground, to be more hidden, to be more private. And of course, if there are societies or cultures or cultural groups that are less concerned about malice toward others, less concerned about these competitive feelings, less concerned about status competition, then you'd think Schadenfreude would be more free. And what we do know is there are certain domains of life where Schadenfreude is more acceptable, like competitive domains like sports or American Idol, where it's an open competition. There we have give people a little bit more room in general to express Schadenfreude. I think this hasn't really been studied as well as it should be just yet.
So is there a positive side to Schadenfreude, or is it only a negative? I mean, it seems it's mostly described in a negative way. I mean, Schopenhauer called it an infallible sign of a thoroughly bad heart and profound moral worthlessness. You know, so that's really disparaging it. And I think it's almost universally regarded as a kind of a shameful emotion almost. Like you have to, you know, you could snicker a little bit, feel it inside. You'd have to be really careful if the whole group would be feeling it, then maybe you could be more open about it and all laugh together. Is there a positive side to it? Is it a safety valve? Is it something that maybe reinforces value systems? I mean, why do we have this emotion? What's it for in an evolutionary sense?
I think it's hard to find a positive side of Schadenfreude. I think it ranges from pretty bad for us to neutral, right? So in those everyday mundane cases where, you know, somebody trips a little bit, but they're fine and they're laughing at themselves, you know, where it's just like a little chuckle or a smile, you know, that's probably neutral. That's not doing any harm. But I mean, I think the reason why it's seen as bad or as negative is because it's very clear that the only reason you can feel Schadenfreude is that you're not in line with the person who's suffering a misfortune. Fritz Haider called this discordant. It's a discordant emotion. It's an antagonistic emotion. So the opposite feeling would be something bad happens to someone else. I should feel bad. This is empathy or compassion or sympathy. And my feeling is in line with theirs because something bad has happened to them. I should also feel bad. And Schadenfreude is the opposite of that. I feel good because something bad has happened to someone else. So I think it's hard to put a positive spin on that. It could be neutral because it's sort of something sort of insignificant, but it is putting us at odds with the other person. We're not sharing a feeling. Our feeling is not in line with what's happening to them. And this is, there's no two ways about it. This is inherently antagonistic, conflictual, you know, discordant, out of line, not empathetic, not sympathetic, not compassionate.
What about the possibility that it helps to establish social hierarchies, and that we are a hierarchical species, and that if hierarchies were challenged all the time, or if there were no safety valves, then there might be even more conflict than we have, and we have an awful lot of it.
Yeah. So for me, then we're moving out of the realm of Schadenfreude, and we're moving into things like Genugtuung, we're moving into things like envy, or what Nietzsche called ressentiment. He used a French word for that, ressentiment. Then we're moving into a range of other things that are different from Schadenfreude. And certainly you can make the argument that, as we've talked about, that feeling good about, you know, hierarchies, about people who don't deserve to be at the top falling a little bit, for example, or people who've gained their advantages unfairly, you know, losing them or losing some of them, this is something different. But yes, I think, you know, you can see that as serving that purpose, or you can see pleasure in ill-gotten gains disappearing, being a way of reaffirming that fairness actually, you know, happens, or that the system is fair. But yet all of that for me takes us outside of Schadenfreude and into, you know, really interesting and complex dynamics of the way that we, you know, negotiate status hierarchies.
So it seems to me that if status hierarchies were justified and always arranged in a deserving way, then taking pleasure at somebody's downfall who's gotten their status in an illegitimate way would make sense. But I think there's also an awareness that sometimes where one is in the dominance hierarchy is a question of luck. It's not that it's ill-deserved, it's just not earned in some way. And there's a kind of pleasure in it, maybe an unconscious pleasure or conscious pleasure, that you can go up a slight rung because someone who was higher got a little lower, and it's sort of regardless of how they got there. So I'm wondering if in that sense it can be a kind of a safety valve, you know, that the tensions involved in not being comfortable at one's rung on the ladder.
No, I mean, I think that definitely happens. I think this is another reason why precision really matters. And, you know, truth be told, Nietzsche, who's probably our most elaborated theorist of Schadenfreude, was not a friend to Schadenfreude. I think it's fair to say he hated Schadenfreude. He thought it was ridiculous. He thought it was immature, precisely because he was a real believer in people taking responsibility for themselves and seeing achievement. He basically thought that achievement and hierarchies were legitimate, and that Schadenfreude and its emotional cousins or siblings were basically, you know, sour grapes, people just being unhappy because they hadn't succeeded. And so the whole justice question, all of these things, is what complicates all of this. And it sort of depends on your model of justice or fairness. If you believe that the people at the top are mainly there because they're better, then Schadenfreude is illegitimate, and it maybe serves a purpose of making people at the bottom feel better, but it's not ethical. It's not based in anything, and that's not based in justice. But if you believe that, you know, the hierarchy is not completely fair, then something like Schadenfreude is also not justice, but it's a way to kind of for people to feel better about something because they can't actually change it. So at the center of all of these discussions is a kind of a your implicit model of justice and the degree to which inequality is fair. And that's what's underneath all these feelings and all these debates. And so in the end, to sort of make these judgments, we've got to kind of come down on whether any sort of system of inequality is relatively, you know, fair or unfair. But Schadenfreude doesn't really do anything to challenge that system because it's such a passive little pleasure. And in fact, that's why some people have argued that it's counterproductive for the people at the bottom because they're not actually doing anything to challenge a system if they think it's unfair. They're just taking a little pleasure in an occasional fall.
So is it a sign of emotional maturity or having good character to feel it less often, and when you feel it, to suppress it right away and say, oh, nah, I'm not going to feel that? I mean, do people have a choice? I mean, usually we talk about feelings, at least in clinical psychology, feelings are just feelings. You can't really control them. What you do with them, you can choose, but not what you feel. But in the discussions of Schadenfreude, I get the sense that it's almost recommended to suppress it.
You know, I come from a different school of emotion that doesn't see them as uncontrolled. I come from a school of emotion really rooted in Jean-Paul Sartre's existential philosophy, which is that emotion, you know, is a choice. And, you know, in the case of Schadenfreude, all the examples that we've talked about, you don't get to that emotion without making assumptions about what's happened and why, whether it's fair or unfair, or whether your standing in the world is fair or unfair. And so, yes, I really come from the school that where all emotion actually is a choice. It is a way of being. To feel Schadenfreude, to feel angry, to feel sad, is a way of being. We choose it because it's a way of giving meaning to our lives and to the world around us. And that is an existential choice. That is a self-defining choice. And so, yes, I think, and there's actually some evidence of this. Richard Smith and I actually did a whole bunch of studies on this ages ago. People who are prone to Schadenfreude and feel it a lot are, you know, not in the best, are not living their best lives. They tend to have lower self-esteem, more depressive affect and symptomatology, are more hostile or more competitive. So yeah, I think there's an argument to be made for, at least for psychological well-being, that we do want to control our Schadenfreude. And we especially want to make sure that if we are feeling that pleasure at other people's misfortunes, that it makes sense, that it has some moral legitimacy, and that we're not using it as a kind of a symbolic way of managing our own, you know, ill feelings about our own position in life. And it's avoidant in that way. If we're upset about our standing in life, taking pleasure in other people's suffering is doing nothing to address our standing in life.
Right. I can see that, particularly when it starts to drift off into more serious kinds of phenomena like sadism and bullying can be really harmful to a group. And presumably harmful to the perpetrator in some deeper way. Whereas Schadenfreude is, I guess, it's almost a sense of like, well, it can it be an innocent pleasure because it's so mild? You know, is it more okay? I mean, certainly it's more okay than outright sadism or bullying. And I understand that you're trying to make a very precise definition. Do you see them as being in a kind of a family of emotions, where one can kind of bleed into the other in a sense, or are they really distinct?
Well, I wouldn't say bleed in, but what I would say, actually, Russell Spears and I have written about this. What I would say is you can see Schadenfreude as a kind of a gateway to more malicious, more aggressive, even something like sadistic torture or pleasure. And so it's a gateway in that people who we feel Schadenfreude toward are people who are basically treating as undeserving of compassion, as below us in some way, or as our competitors or our rivals. And by actually viewing them in this way, we are beginning or on that slope of viewing them as less human, as less equal. And so there is a way we've argued where if a particular person or particular target of people, and this is one way where I think, you know, you could argue that the Nazis and anti-Semitism has operated more generally, is that if there's a group that's targeted as somehow a scapegoat for Schadenfreude, or a group that you project or displace your own feelings of inadequacy onto, it can start out in this kind of really minor way But once you establish someone as below, as not deserving of human compassion, then they are a target that then can also make sense, you know, as a target of more violent or more aggressive treatment, or of indifference to their suffering, and that can get extreme. So I wouldn't say blend into, but certainly as a gateway, because Schadenfreude already sets people up, the target of Schadenfreude, as less deserving of our compassion, our sympathy, and our understanding, this is a first step, and we can continue on that road. And then when circumstances and when motivation is there, start to actually treat those people less well in a more active way. That's the way that I think about it.
So is there some relationship to, in group Schadenfreude, to ethnic jokes? You know, there's a certain ethnicity that gets made fun of habitually. I won't name any ethnicities, but before I went to graduate school, I was working at a halfway house for schizophrenics, and one of them loved telling jokes, and he loved telling ethnic jokes, but he realized how, and this is back in the early 80s, he realized that they were offensive. So he made up an ethnic group called Bimbolians, and he made fun of them.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good example of how it can start off looking sort of innocent. And a lot of those jokes are usually about a misfortune or the group doing something stupid or doing something silly, right? And then taking a little pleasure in it. And yes, it can start off that way, but that's exactly what I mean. It's already, even if it sounds innocent and it's just a joke, it's clear that it's setting up the group as a viable target for mistreatment.
Right, exactly.
Now, it doesn't get you to mistreatment, but it makes the group already make sense as a group that could be targeted for mistreatment. And then if people want to mistreat, they make sense.
Right. They become the butt of jokes that way. And with the remaining time, I'd like to venture into, and I hope we can maybe do this in a way that's accessible to the general audience, to talk a little bit about method. What's the method for studying Schadenfreude and related emotions empirically? I imagine quite different from the way a writer or an historian would do it, which would be probably much more anecdotal. The idea is to try to come up with observable, repeatable kinds of, if not experiments, at least maybe, I imagine a lot of questionnaire kind of studies. But are there also observational studies? And what's the range of empirical investigation of these phenomena?
It's been done by empirical psychologists in a few different ways. And the most common ways are to ask people to recall a time when they experience something like that. And the good thing about studying Schadenfreude is you can't use that word. So you have to describe, you know, a time when it felt kind of good to see something bad happen to someone. And what's nice about that is that it's very precise and you're not cueing people with the word, right? So if you ask people to remember a time when you were guilty, they're already thinking about whether it was good to feel guilty. What does guilt mean? And so one advantage of studying Schadenfreude is that you can study it without saying what it is. And so people don't have to worry as much about what they're talking about. So yeah, recalling a time. And then when they're recalling a time, then you have all sorts of other options. So people can recall a time. And we know that when people recall a vivid episode of an emotion, they actually often begin to relive the emotion. And so even some of the physiological and neurological activity associated with the original experience can be re-experienced or happen again when they're recalling that episode, if it's strong enough. And so you can also have people recall a time when they felt Schadenfreude, and you can measure the movement of the muscles involved in a smile in their face and see if they're actually having a smile that's either visible or not visible with actual muscle movement. There have been a few studies where people, where researchers have put people in an MRI scanner and tried to assess their brain activity when they're recalling an episode of Schadenfreude. So because people relive vivid emotions, you can actually study, you know, any system, physiological, neurological, or language system, when people are remembering an episode. But of course, you know, memory is complicated. Memory is not perfect, and people may not relive that experience in as active a way as actually experiencing it. So yes, some of us also then try to produce Schadenfreude in the lab, so to speak, in a controlled environment. And there, that's often done in a couple different ways. One is to have people basically in think they're in a competition or have a rival. So they're like playing a game, for example. And we've done that. We've like set up these competitions, either that they're part of a team or individually they're competing. And then, you know, a rival fails or suffers a misfortune. And then we try to assess how they say they feel, and maybe even try to assess physiologically or neurologically signs of feeling or emotion. And then the third way is to have people watch episodes that should produce schadenfreude. So, for example, one would be like some colleagues in the Netherlands, Wilco van Dijk and his colleagues, have people watch like, American Idol kinds of episodes to get them to try to feel schadenfreude in a more controlled environment where you can assess it. So those are really the main ways that it's studied.
So in other words, if they're facing or observing a scenario that would evoke schadenfreude and they show the signs of pleasure, then it's assumed to be that feeling. Because obviously we can't do a Vulcan mind melt and know exactly what they're feeling.
Yes.
But we see that there's pleasure, and the word schadenfreude means pleasure in a certain circumstance. And so you make sure that you have the circumstance, and then the pleasure is assumed to be pleasure.
Yes. And then you can, you know, then you can carefully compare, like you can, like, right, because I believe there's a very narrow definition. So then I can produce that circumstance, which I think is the definition of schadenfreude, and I can compare it to other circumstances. And we've done that. So like we've compared schadenfreude to pride, where you actually have achieved something or you've done something, you've really outdone a rival and you've bested them. And we try to show that that's actually a different experience to schadenfreude. Or gloating, you also mentioned, which is another one where not only did we best them, but now I'm actually want them to see that I feel good about defeating them. And so we can take that very precise situation and show that that pleasure that is schadenfreude, that we define as schadenfreude, has a different quality. It's more quiet. It's more hidden. It's less intense. It's less happy. It's more concerned about what other people think about, you know. So that's the advantage of doing this in a controlled way, is that you can also make these distinctions empirically that I've been trying to talk about conceptually.
Mm-hmm. So you're a fan of emotional nuance, it sounds like.
Yeah, I'm a big fan, because that's what's great about it. It's rich, it's nuanced, and so I wouldn't want to lose its best advantage. That's the beauty of studying emotion to me. It is really us living our lives in the world, and it's a really powerful window into psychological experience. So I want all that nuance, because we're rich, complicated beings with complicated lives, and that's what I want to understand.
So let me give you an example that I came across from your colleague, Richard Smith. It was a newspaper clipping exercise where they presented bits of information and then added more information. So the first information is a man is killed in a car accident, and then you see signs of empathy. And then you mention he was drunk. You know, then you see maybe some of the Genugtuung, you know, where it's, obviously the man deserved it. And then you say, oh, and it was a Mercedes. You know, then you're getting mixing maybe Genugtuung with schadenfreude. So he deserved it because he was drunk, but he really deserved it because he was rich. You know, he deserved to be brought
right
down a peg. So you know, it's like, so it's a mixing of, emotions, as we know, at least I think we know, don't actually contradict each other. You can have, you know, love and hate at the same time. You can have anger and sadness at the same time. We can have all kinds of mixtures, including, I would think, mixtures of these somewhat more related emotions of envy and pleasure at seeing justice done, pleasure to seeing someone taken down a rung, all these various status-related emotions. So you can have a mixture, it seems to me. So it's like painting layers of paint, you know, with different reflectances.
Yes. Yeah. No, I absolutely agree with you in general. I'm just going to stick to my guns and say, with that extra information to me, then it's not schadenfreude anymore. So I agree with you in general. There's a lot of mixtures of emotions. But for me, once it's about, you know, the fact that he brought it on himself, this is a major way that we move out of schadenfreude, right? When you suffer something, misfortune, that is seen as you bringing it on yourself through being foolish or silly or immoral, then this takes you out of the realm of schadenfreude for me.
So you can't have both empathy and Schadenfreude at the same time? Because they're often seen as opposites.
No, what I'm saying is in this case, probably something more like Genugtuung, which is that this person brought it on themselves and therefore I don't owe them empathy and I can take pleasure in it because they were foolish and they did this to themselves, but not Schadenfreude.
So if you watch a movie and the bad guy gets killed, can you have a little bit of empathy for them or no? You can't. You could just say, oh, he deserved it.
Yeah, I think, you know, that's what you said, right? So once you've moved into they deserved the bad thing that happened, you are opposite to empathy.
Well, let me give you a biblical example. There's in the book of Judges, there was a battle with, I think it was the Philistines, and the general Sisera was killed by a woman. I think it was either Yudit or Yael, but anyway, she drives a tent peg through his head. She seduces him, gets him really drunk, and they're in the tent, and she takes a tent peg and drives it through his head. It's a really gory, graphic example from the Bible. And then there's this whole passage about Sisera's mother weeping and real empathy by the writer, who is obviously an Israelite, having empathy for the mother of this general who was fighting the Israelites. You know, so you would think that ordinarily there would be just complete glee. It's not Schadenfreude, it's probably something else, but in that realm of, you know, bringing somebody down in status, but also the relief at the enemy being conquered. But both of them are there. I mean, not in the exact same, maybe not the exact same sentence, but it's all there. Or another example is from the Passover Seder, telling the story of the Exodus. Right in the telling of the 10 plagues, the custom is to dip one's pinky into the wine, red wine usually, because it looks more like blood, and remembering the suffering of the Egyptians, because in the Bible it says that God rebukes the children of Israel for celebrating on the other side of the Red Sea, because don't you realize the Egyptians are my children also? So there's a kind of a rebuking of, not, I know it's not exactly Schadenfreude, but a rebuking of having pleasure at the expense of somebody suffering.
Yes. So for me, this is why I like this distinction. So for me, this is really the balance with what I would say these examples are actually about gloating, which is about overboard, very public, celebrating in the face of the vanquished enemy, the success. And that puts us in different territory now, because that is dangerous physically and ethically to be seen as celebrating too much something that also was a gain or, you know, brought about by another party suffering or being vanquished. And so, yes, there is a balance there where gloating is a sort of thing where we have, again, a sort of idea and ethical understanding of how much is appropriate and how much is too much. And so I would see that as there as a balance there between being empathetic to the losers and moderating gloating. Appropriate pride, appropriate celebration that doesn't rub it in the faces of the vanquished or doesn't set the victors up as being not just winning, but then wanting to win again by making the losers suffer.
Right. And there's also, I think, a value on not dehumanizing the enemy entirely, because the enemy may not be your enemy forever.
Yes, that's right. Well, there's also the danger of you know, gloating too much also can be fuel to your enemy to fight again. So yes, I mean, gloating is very, very interesting, but you see already the dynamics of this are very different from Schadenfreude. It's a much more active role. There's a success there or a victory of some kind. It seems like a subtle difference, but for me, it's a very different experience. And therefore, the things that we have to worry about with the appropriateness of gloating are very, very different.
So for you, Schadenfreude is this sort of delicate emotion. I can imagine it being like a delicate flower that needs to be, you know, watered and
yes.
Tended to carefully.
Yes, I've been trying. Yes, I want it to just be. I just want it to be able to flower by itself. And that's the thing about it. I think it's okay if it's this really specific thing that doesn't happen that much. That's probably, we're all probably better off if it doesn't happen so much, and just let it sort of grow in the corner by itself, and gloating and pride are these other things which are really important actually, but different.
Getting back to cultural differences, is it possible for a culture to have an increase in Schadenfreude as a phenomenon? I mean, is the, for instance, the rise of the internet and the ability to make anonymous comments, nasty ones, does that encourage Schadenfreude, or is Schadenfreude just this kind of a universal thing that happens everywhere?
You know, I think there are some websites that are dedicated to providing people these sort of everyday, not too serious opportunities for Schadenfreude. That's true. My point of view, and this is true with most things with the internet, I think, you know, that dynamic has been there. And the difficulty is, the change is, in our past as human beings, you know, we lived in these small groups in a little village, and we had opportunities for Schadenfreude every day if we looked around and we could see it. And now that we're, you know, more separate and living in these bigger societies, we don't have those sort of close examples. And so now we get, we get lots of examples from strangers that we can. So the difference is, we can seek out examples, and there are websites that are dedicated to this. And so, yes, if you're somebody who's really into, if you are a Schadenfroh and you're really into this and it makes you feel good and you start to rely on it in a way to sort of make yourself better about your own life, then the difference is, you now have easy access. You can put in a search term and you can find it, and you can probably find an endless supply of other people's misfortunes to take pleasure in. And that is very different. It's on the supply side that's different.
I have a question about whether this qualifies as Schadenfreude in your mind. The Darwin Awards, which is dedicated to naming people who died and took themselves out of the gene pool by doing something really stupid. Does that count as Schadenfreude? And this is an actual thing. I don't know if it still exists. I read about it years ago. Like, an example would be that he actually didn't die, but if he had, it would have been a Darwin Award. A guy decided to go up in the air by putting helium balloons attached to his lawn chair. And he brought along a handgun to be able to come down, you know, to shoot the balloons.
Shoot the balloons. Oh, wow.
And as it turned out, that, you know, as you go high enough, the pressure differences are such that they pop on their own. And fortunately, they popped gradually enough that he actually survived. But if he had died, that would have been a Darwin Award, right? So so is that Schadenfreude?
I this is probably irritating, but I mean, this is a fun game, actually, and I'm going to say no. Because it's not happenstance. It's not minor. He brought it on himself. It's his own stupidity. And therefore, it looks like a deserved, it's not a misfortune. This is a deserved consequence, or seen as a deserved consequence of his foolish action. So it doesn't meet the definition.
So what would it fall into? What would you call it instead?
Let's see. You know, if there is a way where it, as soon as I use the word deserved, it starts to get into the territory of Genugtuung. It's not a punishment, but it is a kind of just desserts, right? If you're going to be that foolish, then you deserve to break some bones or look foolish. So it's certainly more in the realm of Genugtuung, of pleasure at seeing justice done, at stupid is as stupid does, basically being demonstrated. But because the person brought it on themselves, and it's a consequence of their direct action, their foolish action, then by definition for me, it's not Schadenfreude.
Yeah, it's very, very particular. Well, we only have a couple of minutes left. What would be like your most classic example of Schadenfreude that's absolutely clear?
They're not that interesting. So they're little things. The classic example we've often studied is, you know, you're in some sort of competition at the Olympics. And it's not your fierce rivals. You don't take pleasure in your fierce rivals losing, because that benefits you and that's different. That's something more like gloating or pride or happiness or Genugtuung. But, you know, you take pleasure in, I have to pick the right example. You take pleasure in Kazakhstan losing a fencing final. That would be something more like Schadenfreude. It's nothing to do with you. You didn't cause it. You witnessed it. You don't really gain anything from it, but you use their misfortune to gain a little pleasure. Or it would be the classic example of, you know, kid in the cafeteria tripping over his own feet and dumping his lunch, or at work, dumping his lunch all over the floor. But somebody, not someone you know, not someone you especially dislike or a rival of yours. You just get a little pleasure in seeing something bad happen to somebody.
Can it be a child that you're seeing doing something silly, like watching a baby missing her mouth, trying to feed herself?
Absolutely. I think it's another, that's a very common example, right? And that frees us up for Schadenfreude, right? Because it's not a child, a young child doing something silly like that obviously is not bringing a deserved punishment or suffering on themselves. They're innocent in a way. And this is what frees us up to take pleasure in that little mishap that they miss their mouths with a spoon, or more food ends up in the bib than in their mouth. That's what frees it up to be Schadenfreude.
And that seems pretty harmless to the one experiencing the pleasure, you know, because you recognize that it's just a kid and they're going to outgrow this. It doesn't say anything bad about them.
That's right. I think so. The thing about it, I think the thing to worry about with Schadenfreude is actually in these everyday examples, it's not actually the person who's suffering the misfortune. It's what it says about the person who's using this mundane example to feel good. That's the part that we should worry about. What it says about people who look for those opportunities to take pleasure. And if they do that too much, or they're really looking for opportunities like that, it tells us something about their orientation to others that is lacking empathy or sympathy. That's where we have to pay attention to. It's not really the thing itself that's happening, the misfortune. It's what particular people are making of the misfortune. And when they do it habitually, it really does start to tell us something about their character, which is why Schopenhauer made this exaggerated but still, I think, true point about it. It tells us a lot about the character of the Schadenfreude. If people are walking around looking for opportunities or really taking advantage of these opportunities to feel better about themselves.
So we should worry if we're becoming gluttons for Schadenfreude.
I think we should, yes.
On that note, unfortunately, we're out of time, but who knew it could be so much fun talking about Schadenfreude and other similar emotions. So thank you so much for joining us, Professor Colin Wayne Leach from Columbia University, a social and personality psychologist. So thank you so much for coming to Delving In.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
I'm Stuart Kelter, and you have been listening to the podcast edition of Delving In, originally broadcast on KTALLP, the community radio station in Las Cruces, New Mexico. Please visit our website, lccommunityradio.org, and see what KTAL has to offer. We appreciate listener donations to help us stay on the air and to continue to grow in cyberspace.